I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Climate change, it's an unprecedented global problem, but the impacts will be very local and leave no one untouched. That's a sobering message today from the Obama administration's National Climate Assessment. The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson, has been poring over it and joins me now. So many climate change reports, Peter. What's the gist of this one?
Well, Marco, one of the things that's so striking about this is that most of these big reports are very sort of technical and abstract and sort of looking into the future. This one has an amazing immediacy to it. I mean, I think a casual reader would find it really remarkable how often it speaks in the present tense. There are way fewer references to will and might and could and a whole lot more of is and are, things that are happening now in the United States.
So give me some examples of how this is happening now. I mean, I have a few ideas.
Well, I'll just give you a few bullet quotes. Heavy downpours are increasing nationally. Rising temperatures are reducing ice volume and surface extent on land, lakes, and sea. Climate change is increasing many health risks. Infrastructure is being damaged by sea level rise, heavy downpours, extreme heat. Heat waves have become more frequent and intense. The lead author of the report is a guy named Jerry Melillo, who's a distinguished scientist at the Marine Biological Lab here in Massachusetts. He summed up how things have changed in the science pretty succinctly in a conference call this morning.
For decades, we've been collecting the dots about climate change. Now we have connected those dots.
Okay. Connect the dots for us, Peter. What are the dots?
Well, the report breaks it down by regions as well as by impacts. In terms of some of the regions here in the Northeast, it says communities are already being affected by heat waves, more extreme precipitation, coastal flooding. We certainly saw that in spades in Sandy a year and a half ago. In the Southwest, it talks about drought and increased wildfires and competition for water resources. We're seeing that right now in terms of the California drought. A couple things that really stand out to me, though, haven't gotten as much attention as those events that we have witnessed recently. One is those infrastructure impacts that I mentioned. It says that flooding along rivers, lakes, and cities following heavy downpours, et cetera, are exceeding the limits of flood protection infrastructure, and that extreme heat is damaging transportation infrastructure. This is stuff that's happening right now, and you think about the expense, not merely the immediate impact of the disasters when those things fail, but the expense of replacing those can be just stupendous. And something that's gotten almost no attention is nature's infrastructure, and this report really points at that. Things like forests, barrier beaches, wetlands, all of these play a really important role in protecting people and communities from extreme weather events. And the report says their capacity to do that is already being overwhelmed by climate change. And when you think about all of those infrastructure benefits that we've never had to pay for and we're now going to have to pay to replace because they're being overwhelmed, nature did it for us. It's not going to do it anymore.
This is scary stuff, but then again, I think all these climate change reports are kind of scary. You read these reports, Peter. Do citizens read them? Do they pay attention to them?
I don't know that citizens read them and pay attention to them. I do know that policymakers do. Certainly, this is partly aimed at Congress, and we have a cut again from this morning's press conference from John Podesta. He's one of the top political folks in the White House.
I think the entire lineup of the House Science Committee on the Republican side voted relatively recently to deny the fact that climate change was even happening. So hopefully this report, they might review it and change their minds.
I think there's still a little wishful thinking there on the part of the White House. But this report is not aimed at Congress. It's aimed at everybody else in the country. Folks are already acting on this. I mean, there is a lot going on around the country. So this won't be a complete surprise. It won't be a shot across the bow that folks aren't expecting. But I think that it will distill it in a way that will really help folks frame the debate in terms of what is going to be happening and what we need to do about it.
We've had so many climate change reports at the international level, I mean, in part because it is a global issue. Carbon atoms don't just stop at national boundaries. Why do we need an expensive U.S. study to tell us this is happening when it's already been established and evidence continues to come in from here and everywhere?
Well, actually, it's interesting. I mean, this report was commissioned years ago. This is being done under a law that was passed by Congress several years ago. It's the third in a series of, I think, every four-year reports. Things were different back then. It was more prospective. It was more what's going to happen than what is happening. And over that time, things have shifted tremendously. So in some ways, this is a relic of an earlier period when climate change was much more abstract. But I think, again, also the reality of climate change still hasn't settled into American politics. And documents like these help it do that, help it really take hold in terms of the way people think about, experience, and understand this problem.
The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Denial and misunderstanding are still running strong, despite the overwhelming evidence that climate change is real and here already. That's true here in the U.S., but also in other countries like Australia. Widespread denial there is partly due to the influence of powerful energy interests, but there's more to it than that. As Joanne Silberner reports from New South Wales, Australia, denial can also be an important psychological coping mechanism.
In the late 1990s, a terrible period of dryness struck Australia. It came to be known as the Millennium Drought. Crops failed. Farm ponds dried up. With no water and little grass, ranchers had to shoot their cattle. The catastrophe lasted a decade, and it was quickly followed by another drought. Experts say Australia is experiencing the effects of human-induced climate change, and the heat and dry spells in key agricultural areas are going to get worse. But many farmers in the state of New South Wales brush off these dire predictions. I met farmer Peter Darley as he towed crates filled with apples from his orchard. What does he think of climate change?
Look, at this stage, I'm a skeptic.
Several miles away, rancher Graham Brown told me he sees nothing unnatural in the recent waves of hot, dry weather.
I don't go much on the politics of climate change, but climate variability has been with us since the dawn of time.
And on another nearby farm, Rich Kidd has all sorts of gauges set up to monitor the weather daily.
Does the climate change? Yes, it does. I've seen it change, but I haven't been over to be convinced of what causes it.
And he's not convinced that what Australia has been going through lately is anything out of the ordinary. Now, a lot has been written about denial in the face of climate change. It's often framed as a political position. But some mental health experts, including David Perkins of Australia's University of Newcastle, say at least in the short run, denial can be a practical response to a tough situation.
It's very hard to admit that the world's falling apart.
And Perkins says farmers in particular are used to being able to fix things. Fence down, put it back up. Tractor broken, break out the tools. But looking to a future where there's no water left to bring to the cattle?
To have a problem where they think they can't find a solution is actually, I think, psychologically very threatening. And therefore, you know, denying in a psychological way might be a better way of dealing with it.
In other words, so long as farmers prepare for the next big weather event, as the New South Wales farmers I met say they are careful to do, does it really matter if they don't foresee a whole lot more droughts and heat waves in the next 50 or 100 years? Again, farmer Graham Brown.
As farmers, we just adjust to it, and we have to live with the weather that we're handed out.
And stressing about the weather can have a negative impact on mental health. Several studies have linked droughts to depression. There are also reports of more suicides in drought-stricken areas. There aren't any comparative studies of the mental health of climate change deniers versus believers. But there is a well-documented link between stress and depression, and that's what leads some mental health experts to say denial, by limiting stress, is a constructive coping mechanism. Grant Blaschke is a Melbourne-based physician who studies the health effects of climate change. He doesn't think deniers need any kind of treatment. Lots of people get on fine believing things that are at odds with the evidence.
You know, all of us operate with a level of denial.
We have to, he says.
I mean, as we speak today, you and I could get into all sorts of state about how many kids are dying of preventable diseases and, you know, poverty and nuclear holocausts. And, you know, we could dig ourselves into a real pessimistic, nihilistic hole if we wanted to, but you know, it's not going to help at all.
Still, Blaschke says what might be good for an individual's mental health can be bad for climate change policy. It might divert people from voting on the issue, or trying to limit their carbon footprint, or keep them from advocacy work. Universal denial, he says, would be a bad thing.
I do think that people in positions of authority and positions of responsibility in government, in big businesses, do have a responsibility to really take a long view.
But in Australia, the public is going the opposite way. Denial is on the upswing. According to one survey, in 2007, 73% of Australians were concerned about climate change. 5 years later, just 57% believed climate change was a reason for worry, even as the science is getting more and more certain. For The World, I'm Joanne Silberner, Orange, New South Wales.
8,000 years ago, there was no denial about climate change. There were no climate change assessments, no scientific models on rising seas. So imagine the surprise one day when the good people of Doggerland found themselves being swept into the North Sea. We don't have any direct evidence that climate change caused that, but this story does fill the imagination about the horrific consequences of a big rise in sea level. The world's history nut Chris Wolf joins me now to fill in the blanks. Chris, what exactly is Doggerland and why did it vanish?
Doggerland was a landmass that existed at the end of the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago, that extended from Great Britain and Ireland all the way over to the mainland of Europe and Germany, Denmark and France. And it was slowly swallowed up as the glaciers receded and the sea levels rose. Sea levels rose like 300 feet over 15,000 years. Yeah, we're worried about climate change now. This was some serious stuff going on.
Yeah.
And by about 8,000 years ago, they were reduced to a set of islands about the size of New Jersey. But it was still a rich country with low hills, valleys, rivers, and very rich in forest life, animals, and people.
And why is there excitement about all this now?
Well, a new model's been published of the Stoddinger incident, which is a dramatic landslide and tsunami that occurred about 8,000 to 8,200 years ago. No one's precisely sure. And it's got Doggerland mapped in. This is the first time it's been mapped, taking these set of islands into account. And the Stoddinger incident was this massive undersea landslide that displaced a huge amount of sediment and set off like 45 feet waves sweeping across the North Atlantic. That the amount of sediment that was involved would be enough to bury all of South Carolina under about 25 feet of mud.
Now, incredible. So is there any connection with global warming? Are scientists looking at this tsunami from 8,000 years ago saying, look out, 21st century, this is on our horizon too?
Well, it's debatable. No one really knows what causes undersea landslides. It can be earthquakes and things of that nature. But a lot of scientists agree that rising sea levels does increase the amount of pressure on the land that exists under the sea, and that could make landslides more common. So the takeaway could be that rising sea levels is not a slow linear process. They can be accompanied with these massive episodes of destruction.
How certain are we that people were affected in this Stoddinger incident?
People were definitely affected. A lot of artifacts have been dredged up from the North Sea by fishermen. We're talking stone tools, canoes. They've even located standing stones that you find very common in Northern Europe.
Stonehenge-type things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the evidence now suggests that the tsunami ended permanent occupation in Doggerland, of human occupation. The evidence is thin, but that's what most of the scientists are now saying. The islands continued to be slowly swallowed up over the next 2,000 years or so, but the tsunami pretty much brought the end of human presence there.
People certainly remember the Asian tsunami of 2004. I mean, a quarter of a million people perished in that disaster. Do we have any evidence of collective memory of this tsunami in the North Sea?
Unfortunately, no. We're talking Stone Age people, so there was no written record or of any kind. But, you know, it's nice to imagine that, well, every civilization has an Atlantis-type myth of a great bountiful land obliterated by an enormous flood. So, you know, we can imagine.
The world's Chris Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Still ahead, Russia's dirty words are headed to the swear jar. We'll open it up just enough on The World from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Eight acrobats who were injured in that circus accident over the weekend remain hospitalized in Rhode Island. As you probably heard, the acrobats were suspended, hanging by their hair, when something went wrong and they fell to the ground. The accident reminds us about just how dangerous circus work is, but also just how international the circus world is. The women hurt in that fall were from Brazil, Bulgaria, and Ukraine, as well as the U.S. My next guest is a veteran of the circus world. She's an Australian performer known as Marowa the Amazing. Have you seen this hair hang act, and do you know how it's done?
Yeah, definitely. I actually saw the show a few weeks ago before the accident, so I've seen the actual act. I've always kind of wanted to learn it.
Can you describe just what the act entails?
Yeah, basically you take your hair, which needs to be fairly long to start with, and then you braid it into a particular shape, and a carabiner, which is the type of thing that you would use to hang other circus equipment like a trapeze or silks or anything like that. You actually braid the carabiner into the hair, and then that is in turn connected to whatever's pulling you up into the air.
Did you know any of the performers in the accident?
We've met them. They came to see our show and we went to see their show, but I don't personally know any of those girls. But, yeah, we definitely met them all. And they're really, really sweet. I have a friend in London who does the same act, a Korean girl who does a hair suspension. It's an amazing skill.
When you get to the Ringling Brothers kind of Cirque du Soleil level of performance and skill, is it in fact a small global community where everyone kind of knows everybody else?
Yeah, definitely. I always think there's probably 40 performers that I know quite intimately that are, you know, that are all in shows that I work in and that we all see each other around the world. You know, we link up in Sydney and Australia and, you know, Edinburgh Festival and through Europe and then in America and even in Asia. And then there's sort of an extended family of about 400 traveling from place to place, you know, visas for all different countries and, you know, never going back to the same home. It is still traveling. It is a bit like being in a caravan without being in a caravan, with, you know, being in a hotel instead. But we get along, you know. you have to accept everyone's differences, and it's great. It's a really great environment to work in.
Are there ever any linguistic problems, like people don't speak the same circus lingo?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We've got a great setup in our dressing room at the moment. We have two French Canadians who I constantly tease by speaking in Paris-style French, and they get really annoyed that they want me to speak.
Yeah, that's a sore spot.
Which is always amusing. And then we have a German aerialist, and then we have an American clown, but it's always fun.
What are some of the striking cultural differences in the circus world? I mean, you've seen some circus artists in some pretty weird places.
You know, you've got your really hardcore troops that come out of China that are, you know, touring relentlessly in these big stage shows. And then you have, you know, Cirque du Soleil that's got people from all over the world that are like, you know, lots of European gymnasts that have switched from gymnastics into circus. But also there's a circus in New York at the moment, Universe Soul Circus, which is my favorite circus of all time. And, yeah, they've got an 8-piece African contortion act at the moment, which is amazing.
What'd you learn from working in China? Like, what kind of tricks did you pick up?
Oh, my God. China was insane. Absolutely.
Why?
Insane. We went on a 2-week tour of circus schools, and those kids train harder than anything. We went to one class that was, we were probably in the school for an hour, and there were kids on handstand benches doing handstands that didn't move for the entire time that we were there. For the entire hour, they didn't come down from their handstand. They were just upside down. They train really hard. It's very competitive, you know. It's like they can't have a day off. They just work really hard. But the skills were incredible. We saw a 6-day circus competition in Dalian. There's a tower of chairs in one of the acts. The chairs went up. You couldn't see them. They went up into the ceiling.
No way.
It was just so many. I actually went down to the front of the stage to try and see where they were. It was really mad.
To bring it back to this shocking accident in Rhode Island, do you worry about the safety standards around the world?
Yeah, it's always really, really sad when you hear about something like that, and you don't take for granted, but you forget that there's so many points in every show. You know, there's so much up and down and going up in the air and coming down, and it's kind of amazing that it doesn't happen more often. You know, because there are so many points where, you know, something could go wrong, and it's just that thing you have to really thank and trust and put faith in the riggers that, you know, that the equipment's getting checked over, and, you know, it's going to happen. There are going to be freak accidents, and it's just really sad when it does. And this was just really, really awful, this one. It's just a miracle that no one died. And yeah, grateful for that,
I'll say. Marwa the Amazing, thank you for your time. Great to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you can see Marwa the Amazing spinning and juggling more hoops than you can count at PRI.org. Next up, we travel to a forest in West Africa, courtesy of reporter Diane Toomey. She sent us this audio postcard.
I recently returned from Cameroon, where I spent some time at the Sanaga Young Chimpanzee Rescue Center. This is a rescue center for 72 chimps who've been orphaned by the bushmeat trade. So it provides them very, very large forested enclosures. So they are living a life as close to the wild as you can, but unfortunately still in captivity by necessity. I was a fly on the wall when they did the nightly feeding around dusk. And this is done with a lot of enthusiasm by the Cameroonian guys who are the chimpanzee caretakers. So listen to this. The men begin by taking wheelbarrows chuck full of papaya, bananas, and then they call the chimps in. Some guys use makeshift drums. Most of the guys also call in the chimps by name. A lot of the chimps are waiting at the entrance of the night enclosures because, after all, this is dinner time. But some of the chimps need a bit of sweet talking before they can be lured into these night enclosures. The guiding force is Dr. Sherry Speed. She is an American veterinarian. She founded the sanctuary.
Tonight for dinner, we have bananas and papaya and some rice balls with beans mixed in. We add a little milk and a little oil and some red beans, and so they get their protein from the beans and carbohydrates from the rice. And then they're basically frugivores, and so they get fruit with almost every meal they eat. And tonight it's bananas and papaya.
So they've got their hands out, and they've got the papayas and the bananas placed in their hands, and they're gently peeling the bananas. Some of the chimps will eat right away. Some of the chimps will actually save it for another time. Some of the chimps are very busy arranging their night nests. Some of the chimps will try to steal the nesting material from each other. Some of the chimps are grooming each other. So it's like a very loud, happy Italian-American dinners from my childhood. So as I walked away from the feeding session, I was thinking that it might be nice to have one of those papayas because they looked pretty delicious.
Curiously, I'm suddenly craving papaya. Reporter Diane Toomey sent us that audio postcard from the Sanaga Yang Chimpanzee Rescue Center in Cameroon. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a music video gets a lot of clicks in Scotland. It features a Lady Gaga knockoff who sings about voting no on Scottish independence.
I'm just trying to poke fun at how I just think some of the arguments against independence are so ludicrous.
Plus, Russia tries to ban swearing on stage and screen.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. When talks don't work, slap them with sanctions. That seems to be the Obama administration's foreign policy playbook these days. The latest U.S. sanctions were announced today, not against Russia this time, but against South Sudan. The world's newest nation has been scarred by a deepening ethnic conflict for the past few months. On one side, forces loyal to the country's president. On the other, fighters supporting his former deputy. Both leaders are being pressured to attend internationally mediated peace talks, but progress is slow, and today U.S. sanctions were imposed on two individuals, a military leader on each side. Reporter Andrew Green is in the capital, Juba. He sees a sliver of hope.
The two sides did agree to stop fighting starting tomorrow for a month to allow humanitarian agencies access to corridors where people who have been affected by the fighting are basically just trapped. We have to take it with a grain of salt because there was a cessation of hostilities agreement signed in late January that was violated almost from an hour after it was signed. So we'll see if this latest agreement actually holds, but it is the first time that the two sides have actually agreed on anything since January.
And this so against the background of heavy fighting all week with rebels trying to hang on to the northern oil town of Bentiu. I mean, it's been brutal fighting. Can that be stopped?
Well, that'll be the key question. One of the main concerns is that it's not clear just how much control opposition leader Riek Machar actually has over the forces that are fighting. So while his side can agree to ceasefires or to cessation of hostility agreements, it's not clear that that actually translates onto the ground and that the people who are fighting, for instance, this week in Bentiu, the capital of Unity State, are going to adhere to it. The government, of course, has a little bit more control over its troops, but if they want to take ground, then they've shown in the past that they have no hesitation in violating the cessation of hostilities agreement.
Have you witnessed any of the fighting, Andrew?
I've been to towns in the days after troops were leaving, but I've not actually seen any of the combat.
And what do you see in those towns after those troops have left?
There's virtually no infrastructure left in those places. When I was in Malakal a few weeks ago, the central market is completely gone. Everyone who is in Malakal is now living at the UN base. I'm hearing similar reports from Bentiu after the fighting this week, just that these towns have utterly collapsed and fighting continues. They keep going back and forth between the rebels and the government. So there's no opportunity to rebuild or to get food or clean water into the towns.
Those people who have fled those towns, they end up in refugee or displacement camps right there in Juba. You've been to those. What did you find there?
They're particularly bad situation here in Juba in one of the displacement camps near the airport. It's in a low-lying area. And so now that the rainy season has started and will continue for the next 4 or 5 months, people are living in houses where water is coming up to their thighs, and they have no choice but to sleep in it. I was speaking to a woman a few weeks ago whose son was suffering from severe malnutrition, and she has 2 young children, and every time it rains, she just has to spend the next several hours holding the 2 of them so they don't drown.
And the humanitarian groups who have been to these camps and who have been to these villages that have been destroyed and abandoned, do they have a greater sense of urgency about what to do and how to do it now?
Yes, I think one of the major concerns right now is that South Sudan may be on the brink of famine. It hasn't reached that point yet, but at least 1 million people are severely food insecure or facing dire emergency situations where they're just not getting enough to eat. And as many as 7 million people might not get enough to eat this year, period. And now is the start of the rainy season, which also means that it's the start of the planting season. But because people are displaced, because there's fighting going on, that means that tens and hundreds of thousands of people are not able to plant, which means come November, December, they're just not going to have enough to eat. There's not going to be enough food in this country.
And there are oil resources at play, so it's really complex, and it sounds like it's going to be a tough one to untangle.
Exactly. And then the fighting over the past couple of months has been limited to the oil-producing areas of the states. Riek Machar is very aware of the importance that oil has played. Machar has announced repeatedly that he plans to attack the oil fields, that he wants to hold the country's economy hostage, which is basically what he's trying to do if he's able to take the fields.
Journalist Andrew Green speaking with us from Juba, South Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you.
To West Africa now in the ongoing kidnapping drama in Nigeria. 8 more girls were abducted last night in northern Nigeria. It's suspected the kidnappers were members of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. They're already holding more than 200 girls who were abducted from a boarding school 3 weeks ago. And yesterday, in a video, one of Boko Haram's leaders warned that more kidnappings would follow. Many Nigerians are angry at their government for failing to rescue the girls or even finding out where they are. The United States has offered to help, and today the White House said a U.S. team will head to Nigeria soon to assist in the search. John Campbell is a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He's now with the Council on Foreign Relations. Campbell says the kidnappings have taken place in a remote part of northeastern Nigeria that borders Chad, Cameroon, and Niger.
The countryside up there looks a little bit like West Texas. That is to say, it's not desert, but it's dry, and there's a lot of scrub, and there are mountains. And in fact, to me, this is extremely puzzling. I mean, how do you hide more than 200 girls? This is a remote, isolated part of the country.
Why would Boko Haram do this? I mean, to the girls, specifically abducting these girls? Is it revenue from ransom? Do they just want to terrorize the North and continue that strategy?
No, I think it should be put in the terms of Western education is evil, it's forbidden, it promotes secularism, it promotes state worship. A secular school, from Boko Haram's perspective, it blocks the creation of God's kingdom on earth.
Well, this is totally contrary, isn't it, to Nigeria's state kind of mission. They want to educate everybody. So,
absolutely. Absolute guarantee of religious freedom.
Why did the government take so long to react to this and start kind of really talking to the people whose daughters were abducted?
I think, in my view, the government has handled this whole thing very, very badly. In part, I think, because the government simply does not know what to do.
So when it comes to like the military force of Boko Haram and Nigeria's national military, how do they compare? I mean, what advantages does each have over the other, and what are their weak points?
Well, the Nigerian military has been underfunded for a long time. It's extremely small for a country that has a population larger than that of the Russian Federation. And by all reports, its morale is not particularly good. Boko Haram is a band of true believers, of fanatics, and others who are paid to carry out Boko Haram operations. Boko Haram is involved in bank robberies, in stealing weapons from government armories, so that I don't think money is a particular disadvantage for Boko Haram.
I still don't understand why the government of President Jonathan isn't just sending the Nigerian military out to find these girls.
Well, there are a couple of difficulties with that. First of all, the Nigerian military, in terms of numbers, is probably larger than Boko Haram. On the other hand, the number of people in the north who support or acquiesce to Boko Haram is also large. Then there's a further strategical and tactical issue, and that is, in previous kidnapping cases where there has been an effort to free the victims through military action, the kidnappers have simply murdered them right on the spot.
And this all takes place on the eve of the World Economic Forum on Africa, which is going to be in Abuja for the first time ever. How is that forum going to play against the backdrop of this crisis in the north?
Well, I would suspect that the World Economic Forum may have contributed to Shekau's decision.
The leader of Boko Haram.
Yeah, the leader of Boko Haram. Well, a leader of Boko Haram.
A leader of Boko Haram.
To issue his video yesterday for Shekau and company. The administration in Abuja is evil, and therefore anything that you can do to embarrass or discredit it is something that you will try to do. Now, security, I understand, in Abuja now is extremely tight, but I don't think we can rule out the possibility that Boko Haram might try to stage another action.
So without tearing Nigeria in two, how do you deal with Boko Haram? How do you resolve this?
Very, very difficult question. Nigeria has national elections in 2015. The elections are part of the context here, not for Boko Haram, but for how the Nigerian establishment responds to Boko Haram. The Nigerian establishment is basically made up of competing and cooperating elites. What Boko Haram is an attack on those elites. What is new here is that in Lagos, in Abuja, and in Port Harcourt, and in the financial community in London and in New York, the depth of the crisis has largely been ignored because the issues have been in the far north. What the kidnapping of these girls has done is that it's brought it very close to home, and it has now stirred up Nigerians to ask essentially, why isn't the government doing more?
Former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria John Campbell, thank you.
Thank you.
In South Africa, the question is, why isn't the government doing more to stop corruption? People there are tired of politicians enriching themselves at the public's expense. Some have even lost faith in the institutions that are supposed to rein in corruption. But now South Africa has a new champion in the anti-corruption fight, and her work could have an influence on South Africa's national elections, which are happening tomorrow. Andres Kelta reports from Cape Town.
In a downtown office, Tiko Mofokeng leans forward in his chair, waiting for his number to be called. Mofokeng is from a low-income neighborhood on the outskirts of Cape Town, where most people live in shacks. He says the area has a serious problem with drainage.
When it rains, then water obviously comes into our houses, right through the front door.
He says he's notified everyone he can think of about the problem, but no one's done anything.
So that's why I came to the public protector.
The public protector is South Africa's ombudsman, someone the public can turn to when the government doesn't do its job. Ruthven van Rensburg, who works for the public protector, says the office received more than 40,000 complaints last year, most of them pretty mundane.
Problems with issuing of IDs, birth certificates, death certificates.
But recently, the Public Protector's Office began taking on bigger cases, including one that reached the highest levels of government.
Honorable member, let me make one thing quite clear.
For the past 2 years, South African President Jacob Zuma has been caught up in a massive corruption scandal. It's alleged that he oversaw a $23 million renovation to his private home, paid for with government funds. In a special meeting of parliament, Zuma claimed that the improvements were necessary.
I was approached to allow security upgrades or enhancement to be made.
But critics noted that the upgrades included an amphitheater, swimming pool, and many luxury items. The government agency that oversaw the renovations launched an investigation and found no wrongdoing on Zuma's part. But that's not really surprising, says Danwood Chirwa, a law professor at the University of Cape Town. Many government agencies, he says, have a poor track record when it comes to investigating corruption, including the police.
In South Africa, the institutions that are supposed to be dealing with corruption are not doing it.
So instead, a group of citizens asked the Public Protector's Office to investigate the claims. The head of the office, a woman named Tuli Madonsela, agreed. 2 months ago, she released a scathing 447-page report.
Greetings on behalf of the Public Protector team.
The report, unveiled at a highly anticipated press conference, found Zuma and other officials guilty of improper conduct and maladministration. Madonsela recommended that Zuma pay $2 million, the cost of upgrades that could not possibly be considered security enhancements. But because the public protector doesn't have legal power to enforce anything, says law professor Danwood Chirwa, Zuma is unlikely to pay the fine.
That's only a recommendation. It is not binding, and it cannot be enforced in courts.
But Chirwa says the public protector does have a certain power.
The public attention her reports generates is itself a means of enforcement. And I think that's the only powerful tool that she has.
A few weeks after her report was released, thousands of people marched in Cape Town to protest government corruption. Archbishop Desmond Tutu and other religious leaders participated. Dean Michael Weeder, who organized the event, says it was also a statement of support for the public protector.
She's really set us a good example as South Africans how to hold the line and to preserve the integrity of your office.
Cecil Ann Pierce, who took part in the march, says she's disgusted that the government would spend $23 million upgrading the president's home.
That could feed more than a million people in this country or give out decent housing to people.
And Pierce says when national elections are held tomorrow, she won't vote for Zuma's party, the African National Congress.
I mean, I've never thought I'd not vote for the ANC, but this time round, unfortunately.
I just can't, she says. And the reason? The corruption revealed by the Public Protector's report. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
They're breaking out the swear jar in Russia, or maybe more like the swear bucket. Yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a law that bans obscenities from movies, plays, and the mass media. The fine for using foul language will be as high as $1,400 for organizations and $70 for individuals. As to the words that have been outlawed, sorry, the FCC won't let me repeat them here. Let's just say Russians will have to stay away from four specific terms that refer to the male and female reproductive organs, copulation, and women of loose morals. The four outlawed words are at the root of a kind of Russian dirty talk called mat.
You can take these four words that have been mentioned in the new legislation, and you can make them into adjectives, you can make them into adverbs, you can make them into verbs, and you can do all sorts of unlimited things with these words. It can express anything.
That's Professor Yanni Katsonis, director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia at NYU. He says good luck trying to get Russians to clean up their language.
Swearing is rampant. You'll have swear words, those four base words in different forms, used in practically every sentence, the way that a Canadian might say hey. A Russian would use something, well, words like that. It's done almost as a tick.
That's not stopping Putin, though. Katsonis says the obscenities ban the president just signed is just one of many measures aimed at creating a sort of cultural re-entrenchment in Russia.
And you never know when you've crossed the line. So it makes everybody feel insecure. And in that regard, it's part and parcel not only of the cultural retrenchment, it's part and parcel also of making people feel that they're on unfirm ground.
Russians have 2.5 more months to use their salty expressions in the arts and media. Then they got to go get some mouth soap. Putin's new obscenities ban goes into effect on July 1st. We end the show today with a weekly feature we like to call Sideways Glance. It's a space we carve out on the program to highlight our quirkier tales. On the face of it, this story seems pretty straightforward, but don't be fooled. In September, Scotland will hold a referendum about whether it should remain part of Britain. The two sides of the independence debate are working hard to win over voters. Many say the Yes campaign in favor of Scottish independence has more energy on its side, but the No side, those voting to stay in Britain, is still ahead in the polls. In Glasgow, however, there's a young woman who's come to embody both sides, not unlike the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Corey Princell's got the story.
If there's an ordinary, respectable character in this tale, it's Dr. Zara Gladman. She's in her late 20s, she recently got her PhD, and she now works doing outreach for an annual science festival in Glasgow. Zara is going to vote yes in the independence referendum because of some of the things she really cares about.
Things like care for the elderly and prioritizing free education are important to me.
For her, independence would give Scotland the chance to become great. But Dr. Zara Gladman has another side, an outrageous other side. Lady Alba.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Caught in a bad romance. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Caught in a bad romance. No, 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 no. No, no, Connie, no, 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 no. I'm voting no.
Lady Alba crashed into Scotland with this video, which went viral. It's as if Lady Gaga had taken a sudden interest in the Scottish referendum.
I want your weapons, I want student fees. I want a country run by Tory MPs. I'm voting no. No, 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 I'm voting no.
Like Gaga, Lady Alba has crazy makeup and soda cans rolled into her platinum blonde hair. Though hers are cans of Iron Brew, Scotland's iconic orange soda. Her name, Alba, is the Gaelic word for Scotland. But despite these signs of Scottish pride, Lady Alba just can't see herself leaving Britain. She just really likes things the way they are.
I want your love even if it's wrong. I like being told what I should do.
When it first came out, the video was something of a mystery. The backup dancers wore paper face masks of politicians, and Lady Alba's real face was hidden by all that makeup. But there was, of course, someone who knew what was going on here. Dr. Zara Gladman.
I'm just trying to poke fun at how I just think some of the arguments against independence are so ludicrous.
It started with the Lady Gaga song. Zara thought it would be perfect as a parody. She rewrote the lyrics, came up with the costumes, and filmed at famous spots around the UK, like Edinburgh Castle. Then she put the whole thing up on YouTube.
Then me and my flatmate and my friend were just crowded around the computer refreshing and looking at the hits go up. We're all very excited.
Lady Alba soon needed a Facebook page to manage all her fans. She does media interviews, and she always sticks to her message.
Yeah, my message is just to vote no, because... why would you vote yes?
The humour started to catch the attention of established comedians. Kier McAllister is one of those who saw Zara's video.
First of all, it's very Scottish. It's a very Scottish sense of humour. And Scottish people, when we always laugh at ourselves when we kind of downscale things. And it's just a really clever piece of satire.
On this evening, Lady Alba is performing at the Stand Comedy Club in Glasgow. The whole show is about the independence debate, and it's sold out. As I chat with people in the audience, I have no trouble finding almost as many who are planning to vote no as those planning to vote yes. There are divisions within families. But as Lady Alba comes out on stage at the end of the night, wrapped in a Scottish flag, they're all laughing. And it's easy to see how Scotland will still be Scotland, no matter what happens in the referendum. As for Zara Gladman, well, I did wonder, all this time she's been spending as Lady Alba, is it having any effect? Zara says no.
I don't have any kind of weird conflict going on in my head, like, oh, maybe she's right. I just kind of
try and put on a character and that's it.
This week, she's been at it again. There's a new Lady Alba video out, and it's quite a bit different from the first. But Zara hopes it will be just as effective.
So I think that's the power of comedy, like dispelling apathy and getting people thinking. It doesn't need to be all slapstick. It can get people engaged.
For The World, I'm Corey Princel.
We have photos of Dr. Zara Gladman and Lady Alba, plus a video that put Lady Alba on the map, all at PRI.org. And here's a taste of that new video Corey mentioned. It's called Nuclear Love.
In the town where I was born, left some weapons beside the sea. I was told...
Wait, isn't that... Nah. That's our program today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Submarines. We all live in a yellow nuclear powered ballistic missile submarine. Yellow nuclear powered ballistic missile submarine.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.